Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. In 1838, Frederick Douglass was just 20 years old when he disguised himself as a sailor and ran for his freedom. Douglass went on to become one of the nation's most celebrated abolitionists, orators, and political activists, using the moral authority of his own experience as a slave to thunder at the moral corruption of slavery, the hypocrisy of American values, and the true call for freedom. Douglass is a towering figure in U.S. history. The epic scale of his life and accomplishment, however, has sometimes cast a shadow obscuring the complexities of the man. His views on women's suffrage and Native Americans, for example. But a new biography, the most significant in nearly 30 years, delicately explores those complexities in the life of a man who's rightly called an American hero. This hour on Point, the life and legacy of Frederick Douglass. And you can join us. What do you know about Frederick Douglass, about his great speeches, about his life, his radical patriotism, or his famed abolitionist activities? Have you been turning the pages of the new biography? And what do you think the lessons his life hold for us today? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And joining us now from New Haven, Connecticut, is David Blight. He's a professor, scholar, and public historian. He's the director of the Gilder Lehrman Center for the Study of Slavery, Resistance, and Abolition at Yale University. And he is author of the spectacular new biography. It's called Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom. Professor Blight, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Meghna. I'm very glad to be here.
It's a delight to have you. And if I may start off with a slightly cheeky question, if I may.
Go for it.
What made you want to take this on? Because Frederick Douglass himself is his own best biographer, is he not? He during his lifetime, wrote three autobiographies in 1845, 1855, and 1881.
He surely did, and the first problem any biographer of Douglass faces is that the subject is always right there sitting in your way. He wrote 1,200 pages of autobiography, three different versions, one early in his 20s, one in his 30s, and then one as an older man in the 1880s. And he protected himself. He guides you through. And there's a great deal about his, particularly his private and more domestic life, that he simply does not tell us.
Right.
So a biographer has to find a way under, through, around the great autobiographies. At the same time, you have to, of course, use them. Now, I thought I had Douglass out of my life. I did my first book on Douglass way back in graduate school. I edited editions of his first two autobiographies, I wrote essays on Douglass, etc. But I had Douglass pretty well put to rest, even though he was a part of every other book I had done in some form, until I encountered a private collection of Douglass manuscripts and materials, an extraordinary collection owned by a man named Walter Evans in Savannah, Georgia, about 12 years ago. And it was that chance encounter with that collection that, not overnight, but it made me realize that there's a whole new take here, particularly on the last third of Douglass's
yeah.
life, that would enable someone, and if I didn't do it, somebody else would, to write a new life of Douglass. So I took it on.
Well, and we're very glad that you did because I mean, I think Frederick Douglass is one of those great figures of American history who really whose entire life from beginning to end encapsulates the worst of America and the best mm-hmm. of America. And mm-hmm. in order to explore, you know, what all that means in honest detail is a great value to us all. So I want to yeah. get to that sort of that last third of his life that you were talking about in your new biography. But for a yeah. moment, though, can we just start with the beginning? Because I think, you know, maybe for a new generation of Americans, it's worth spending a couple of minutes talking about Douglass's early life in enslavement. And
yes.
And in order to do that, if I may, in preparing for this conversation yesterday, I was sort of inspired to once again look back at his own biographies, his own autobiographies. And this is just one of the many spectacular passages from the narrative of the life of Frederick Douglass, an American slave, which he wrote and published in 1845. Mm-hmm. And he tells the story of, as a child, mm-hmm. watching his own aunt be tortured, mm-hmm. really is what it is, by an overseer named Plummer. I just want to read this because, if I may, can I just read this one little excerpt?
Sure.
Because people need to know, like, this is what was happening, and Frederick Douglass bears witness to this. He describes his aunt, also, you know, an enslaved woman, was once whipped by this overseer named Plummer. He had bound her wrists. And this is a little hard to hear for folks. I just want to warn them. He had bound her wrists with heavy rope, tied her hands to a hook that was hanging from a ceiling joist. And then Frederick Douglass, who was just a child then, cowering in a closet as this is going on, he writes, "He would whip her to make her scream and whip her to make her hush, and not until overcome by fatigue would he cease to swing the blood-clotted cowskin. I was quite a child, but I remember it. I shall never forget it whilst I remember anything. It was the first of a long series of such outrages, of which I was doomed to be a witness and a participant. It struck me with awful force. It was the blood-stained gate, the entrance to the hell of slavery, through which I was about to pass."
Yes, that is quite a passage. You read it beautifully. Two powerful things are happening in that passage. One is Douglass's amazing ability with words and even with metaphors to capture these kinds of traumatic, brutal experiences. And you've also there found, secondly, it is one of his first vivid childhood memories. His memories really begin when he was dropped off at the Y House plantation by his grandmother when he was about 6 years old, 5 and 6 years old. He'll spend more than a year there. He didn't really even know his mother to speak of at all. He had vague memories of her. But he experienced or witnessed about every kind of depravity, brutality, physical treatments, and mental humiliations that slavery could wreak upon people, mm-hmm. whether they were adults, proud adults, or whether they were children. And he did witness that in a kind of a crawl space closet.
Right.
The overseer doing this beating, of course, didn't know he was there. And Douglass witnessed many other such beatings of people. He names the overseers. He names the slaves. He had an uncanny ability to recollect people and events on the Y plantation,
right.
as well as later. And it needs to be understood that in the 20 years that he grew up as a slave and came to early adulthood, he had seen both the horrors of slavery in the plantation rural world of the eastern shore of Maryland. He had worked as a field hand. He had been beaten himself many times. He also, to his great good luck, spent nearly half of those 20 years in Baltimore.
Right.
In an urban setting, which ultimately had everything to do with making it possible for him to escape.
Right. He talks about how in that urban setting, slave owners were less likely to publicly brutalize the enslaved men and women who I don't even know the right language to use. I don't want to say owned them, but that's what it was.
Yes, it was. They owned them as property.
Yeah.
But in Baltimore,
it just seems so
also,
dehumanizing to say that.
Well, it is. Yeah. I know. It is. Well, it was a dehumanizing institution. And actually, Douglass writes powerfully in many places, not just in the autobiographies, about how he always worried more about slavery's capacity to destroy his mind than he did his body.
Right.
He said, you know, they can do what they do to one's body, which is easy to say. But he worried more about the mental damage, the humiliation, the interior kinds of scars that slavery could lay upon a person. And he walked out of slavery with plenty of those scars.
And this is one of his great geniuses, right? Because he repeatedly throughout his life, in his mm-hmm. autobiographies, in his orations, mm-hmm. talks about exactly what you're talking about, that it's the brutality of the system. While he names individuals in his lives, he looked at the system of slavery and the violence that it was wreaking upon the souls of the enslaved men and women and upon the nation. He's the one who said, this is an entire organization mm-hmm. that America must not rely on anymore.
And one of the most brilliant parts of his writing about this that he said is that he said the system also destroys the minds and the hearts and souls of slaveholders themselves. It poisons and destroys all that it touches. Classic case in point was his mistress in Baltimore. Her name was Sophia Auld. She's the one who teaches him his alphabet, his letters, for a year and a half when he's 7 years old and 8 years old. This was the most prized possession Douglas would ever gain, access to language, and he loved her for it. He called her angelic until her husband forced her to stop teaching him. And then she turned. She became this kind of demon in his mind who had once been his like mother-like protector. Even Sophia Auld, whom at first he took to, he's only 7 and 8. He took to her as a mother figure who was going to teach him. And then suddenly she became simply part of that vast system.
Huh. Well, I am speaking this hour with David Blight. He is a professor, scholar, a public historian, and author of the spectacular new biography of Frederick Douglass. It's called Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom. When we come back, we're going to talk more about Douglass's early life, about his flight to freedom, and about the complexities of his later life as well. And we want to hear from you. What are your questions for David Blight about the life of Frederick Douglass? And what are the lessons we ought to be taking from Douglass's life now in 2018? I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with David Blight. He's the author of the tremendous new biography, Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom. Professor Blight, just before the break, you had mentioned kind of almost offhand that Frederick Douglass did not know, or almost certainly did not know his mother. But did he know who his father was?
No, he did not know. Throughout his life, he tried to figure that out. He never stopped searching for exactly who his father was. What he did know is that his father was white and probably one of his two owners. I mean, those were always the rumors swirling around him that, your father was your master, your old master, your new master, or one of them. But he never found out, and he tried hard. He even went to the near deathbed of Thomas Auld, his second owner, in 1878, back out on the Eastern Shore, spent about 20, 25 minutes with him, and asked him, in effect, and he did not get a yes from Thomas Auld. So Douglass, I mean, one of the first facts people need to understand about Douglass to understand much of the rest of his personal life is that he was first and foremost an orphan. Mm-hmm. He didn't really know his mother to speak of. He had to kind of invent images of her. And he never did know who his father was, but he knew he came from this world of mixed race, probably, sexual assault, the brutality that was always there as the potential for any young black woman. His mother, Harriet Bailey, had 5 children, and she only lived to be about 30 years old. And he came from that environment, that fact of slavery, and he always knew it. And race, of course, the idea of race, was a very complex and troubled issue in the 19th century. And one of the things Douglass analyzed so well, among many others, when he becomes an adult intellectual, was this very concept of race, this very idea that race would be some kind of biological concept. And he, in very modern ways, came to analyze his own mixed race identity, if you like, as something that, he gained from 2 sides, he gained from 2 worlds, but he never considered race a biological thing. He considered it a historical phenomenon.
It's so interesting when, we learn about the details of Douglass's own life. I look back at his writings, and each word seems to carry that much more weight, right? Because I'm seeing here that, at one point in time he wrote, "Men do not love those who remind them of their sins unless they have a mind to repent," and that child's face is a standing accusation against him who is master and father to the child.
Well, you have read Douglass, and with some care, I can tell. And the point is that if one does read Douglass, whether it's in the autobiographies or it's in his short form editorials, he wrote hundreds of them in the 16 years he edited his own paper, or in the great speeches, the first thing you realize about Douglass, and frankly the reason we're here talking about him, is that he became with time a genius with words, with language. There are reasons and ways he came by that, but he had that ability, that rare ability, to find in the words a way to explain a huge event, a huge crisis, a catastrophe, a disaster, a triumph, a turning point in human affairs, a political problem. He had the ability, sometimes in a single sentence, as you just demonstrated, sometimes in a paragraph, that just hits you between the eyes and you stand up and recognize. He had that capacity with metaphor and with words to explain what is happening to us, which is, in effect, the essential definition of the idea of a prophet.
Right.
And it took me some time to get the confidence to put that word prophet in the title. But finally, I did get the confidence because I do believe he stands in that ancient tradition of the prophetic voice.
Of the multiple amazing things about Douglass's life in the context of America and American history is that everything you said I completely agree with, but even as he was emerging as this powerful thinker and orator about the institution of slavery in America, that do I have this right, if I remember correctly, that early on, for example, audiences in New England, abolitionist audiences in New England, were telling him that he was too intelligent. His articulation of the problem was too good that he should have, quote, more of the plantation about him.
Right. Too good to be true. Yeah, well, he even got that from some of his abolitionist associates who wanted Douglass to be the kind of exhibit, the escaped slave who could get up and speak and just tell your story, Fred, tell your story, Fred. With time, that wasn't enough for him. He wanted an independence of mind. He wanted respect as a thinker, and he especially wanted respect as a writer. There were suspicions that somehow you couldn't have been a slave because you're too eloquent. On the other hand, in his first few years out on the circuit, when he's only that is the abolitionist circuit, when he's only 23, 24, 25 years old, he was not a perfectly well-formed orator yet. No one is at that age. He had to learn it, and he learned it by practicing. He learned by repetition. He learned by watching some of his fellow abolitionists. And he developed a gift that he already had. He developed this gift of oratory even while he was a slave, a teenager out on the Eastern Shore, and then a late teenager in Baltimore. He was involved in a debating society in the free black community of Baltimore. He attended on and off four different churches in Baltimore. He names them. He names all the preachers. He names the ones he liked best and the ones he didn't. He had heard the sermonic tradition of Christianity in all sorts of forms well before he ever escaped from slavery. But it took time for him to develop this great skill with language and this particularly this craft, this art of oratory.
Well, you know, Frederick Douglass's life is such that we could spend hours talking about every step, literally, that this man took in his life. But I do want to touch upon the parts that are lesser known, the parts that you really explore in detail in a new way in your new biography.
And first, the contradictions.
So first of all, you know, I have referenced Douglass's own writing multiple times already in this conversation, but he almost never wrote about his first and longest term wife, Anna Murray. Tell us who she is and why did he not write about her that much? She's a really pivotal figure in his life.
She's a terribly important figure in his life and certainly in the lives of his children. Anna Murray was a free black woman he met in Baltimore when he was a late teenager. She was about 3 years older. She had been born out on the Eastern Shore, only about 3 miles from where he was born. They might have even played at the same mill as children on the Tuckahoe River. We don't know that for sure. He meets her in Baltimore, where she worked as a domestic servant for a white family. He would have met her either at a church or in some activities of the free black community of Baltimore. You got to remember, Baltimore had a much larger free black population than it did of slaves at that time. And they fell in love, clearly, when he was 18 or 19. And his escape plot, when he hatched it, Anna was very involved with it. Without a question, she was involved with it. He escapes at age 20 in August of 1838, dressed as a sailor, disguised in a big broad-brimmed hat and a black cravat and the pantaloons. And in one pocket he had a little bit of cash that Anna gave him. And in the other pocket he had his copy of The Columbian Orator, which was this magical book he had found when he was about 12, which was an, you know, a manual of oratory, which he carried out of slavery with him. But when he escaped in this incredible, brave plot of taking three trains and two ferry boats for 36 hours from Baltimore to New York City, and when he got into Manhattan, he sent a letter back to Baltimore. We don't know who he wrote it to, but obviously there were other people involved in the plot. That letter then was given to Anna, although Anna was illiterate and remained a non-reader the rest of her life.
She then got on the same trains
and followed him north, which was just as brave of her.
Professor Blight, forgive me for interrupting you there, but there's something I want to ask you about that. So she never learned to read or write, but Douglass obviously could, and in fact, at an earlier time in his life, he had tried to teach other fellow African Americans to read and write. Did he never teach her?
Oh, yes, he tried.
He tried, okay.
So did his daughter Rosetta, their oldest. So did others. He even hired a tutor at one point or more than one point.
I see, okay.
Anna never learned a full literacy. None of us really know entirely why. But this was one of the ironies, contradictions, and difficulties of a 44-year marriage, five children, many moves. Anna became a thoroughly domestic woman who made a great home. She became famous for her orchards and her garden up in Rochester. She ran a very stern home of rectitude, according to some short memoirs we have by the children. But the most famous black man of letters and literature, frankly, in the world by the 1850s, 60s, and 70s was married to a woman who could never really be part of his intellectual life, of his professional and activist world. She almost never traveled with him, and she remained the homemaker. Now, that's not surprising about the 19th century, but it meant that this was a marriage under a certain definition of his role out in the public, thoroughly public life, public world, and he traveled all the time. In fact, I speculate in the book that he might have been the most traveled American of the 19th century. But her role then was raising the children and keeping a house alive back home. And I must add here that from the earliest years there in the late 1830s, early 1840s, when they came into the North and started to make a life, started to have children, all the way well past the Civil War, Anna made his home. And without it, it isn't clear at all how Douglas could have survived. We even have evidence that she did keep the bank accounts. She had no problem counting. She kept the account books sometimes for the family. Anna is a deeply important presence in Douglas's life, but for biographers, she is difficult to get to since she left nothing of her own writing. However, three of the four children all wrote narratives of one kind or another about their mother and about growing. In fact, one of them is called Growing Up in the Douglas Home, written by their son Charles. And others commented on Anna at different times. So we do have ways to get at Anna's presence.
Right.
And I tried every way I could to weave her into the story at every point that I could find a way to do it.
Professor Blight, if I may, I have been monopolizing the conversation with you. And we've got some callers who'd like to have their say. So let me turn to Ricky, who's calling from Columbus, Georgia. Ricky, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you, and great show. I wanted to comment about something that has always, I guess it just stuck in my mind, that we call slaves abolitionists. And as I read just a definition, the first definition I got, it says, a person who favors the abolition of a practice or institution, especially capital punishment or formerly slavery. And that just always, as a black man, is always, I would think that, all blacks are abolitionists. I think abolitionists should be a term that really that Caucasians have, not us. We were slaves. Always was something that I thought about it.
Yeah, Ricky, thanks for your call. Professor Blight, go ahead.
Sure. Well, Ricky, I take your point. However, there were black and white abolitionists who came from various and different kinds of backgrounds. There were lots of fugitive slaves who escaped into the North and joined the anti-slavery movement. They joined as orators, they joined as fundraisers, they joined as activists in their community, and some of them founded their own newspapers. So if we can also accept that a definition of an abolitionist was a person who devoted his personal energy, his personal resources, their lives, really, to the crusade to destroy slavery, that would be anybody who joined seriously that kind of movement. The term historically fits both blacks and whites, and it fits any nationality, any culture that saw slavery as a moral evil and went out to try to destroy it.
Well, so Professor Blight, that leads me to one of the another question I had about the complexities of Douglas's own thinking and the evolution of his own thinking, because of course from the beginning he had the moral authority of his own experience to point out the moral corruption that slavery at the heart of American slavery. But in the run-up to the Civil War, though, did he stop believing that moral suasion could be the way to change things, and that perhaps just and that politics and war were the only way to bring an end to the institution of slavery in America?
Yes, he did. And he began to make that shift from what we tend to call moral suasion, that is penetrating the human heart to change the world rather than always worrying about changing law and the political world. He begins to make that change in the late 1840s when he came back from Britain in 1847. He undergoes a terrible breakup with William Lloyd Garrison, his former mentor, the man whose anti-slavery society in Massachusetts sort of was Douglass's abolitionist home for several years. And in the 1850s, Douglass embraced fully the politics of abolition. He embraced political parties to an extent. He embraced what they called the anti-slavery interpretation of the Constitution. He even embraced the possible uses of violence against slavery if necessary. He got involved himself in fugitive slave rescues and with his newspaper. And this is what's important. He made tremendous use of the Rotary Press. He wrote editorial after editorial about every kind of crisis and issue about the expansion of slavery and the politics of slavery, whether it was the Fugitive Slave Act, the Dred Scott case, secession itself, all throughout the 1850s. Douglass became quite the political activist and even a political pragmatist, right, because he had to.
Well, we're speaking with Professor David Blight. His new biography is Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom. We'll be right back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're speaking this hour with David Blight. He's author of the new biography, Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom. And Professor Blight, I have to say, we've got a lot of response coming in to this conversation online. Someone over Twitter, someone calling themselves Auntie Entity, was reacting to earlier in this conversation. I was struggling with saying that white Americans owned black Americans in slavery. And Auntie Entity says, say owned. The persistent whitewashing of American slavery and indeed all of American history is exactly why this country is riddled with festering social cancers of all kinds. And Auntie Entity, if you're still listening, I have to say I definitely take your point. My struggle with it was not an effort to whitewash history, but rather just feeling the pain of the truth of American history. Still. To this day. So I just wanted to let her know that. And I keep going back to Frederick Douglass's own writings themselves. And David Blight, I'm just going to quote him again here.
Sure,
because, you know, in the pain and the truth of slavery, there was another section of one of his own autobiographies where Douglass was writing about hearing men and women sing songs as they were enslaved. Mm-hmm. And he says that the hearing of those wild notes always depressed his spirit and filled him with ineffable sadness, that he has frequently found himself in tears while hearing them. Mm-hmm. To those songs, I trace my first glimmering conception of the dehumanizing character of slavery, and I can never get rid of that conception. So,
yeah, beautiful words, but what he's describing there is his memory as a child at the White House plantation. He said this always happened on allowance day, which was one day every month when all the slaves from around the vast Y plantation would come to the big house to get their monthly allowance of supplies and food and so on. And he said you could just hear the songs emanating from the woods. And there's a passage there at the end of that paragraph where he says, if you want to understand the dehumanizing elements of slavery, go sit in the piney woods and listen to the sounds. That was Douglas saying, you know, as a child, I didn't get those songs. I didn't quite understand the moans or the tapping of the feet or the lyrics, but I could tell these were the songs from the sorrows of people's hearts. But also he does go on in that passage to say people also were finding a spirit in those songs, a spirit to declare their humanity. It's another one of those amazing memories that he pulls out of his childhood that helps us find that interior world of what it meant like to be a slave, which is, as the person online just said, slaves were property. And in somewhere in their childhood, every child came to an awareness by some event, some episode, that they were indeed owned, that they were property. Whereas a white playmate, for example, was not.
Yeah.
Every child who wrote about, who grew up to write about slavery as their experience had that kind of moment.
Mm. Well, let's go to Larry, who's calling from Somerset, Kentucky. Larry, you're on the air.
Hi, David.
Hello, Larry.
Hey. Yes, I was just reading a little bit about Frederick Douglass and his speech that he gave on 1852, the Rochester's Ladies Anti-Slavery Society asked him to speak on the 4th of July.
Right.
And, you know, what I was reading said that he seemed obliged at first to, you know, come in and just lift up the whole ceremony. Mm-hmm. And then he turned to saying your nation, your founding mm-hmm. fathers, mm-hmm. and as Douglass was a Christian, he quoted Psalm 137 about the slavery in Israel, and he quoted that to him and pretty much laid down a pretty heavy sermon to him. And
he did.
And then he quoted Isaiah and started talking about their hypocrisy. I just wanted you to talk about that day and maybe what went on that day.
That's the greatest speech of Douglass's life. Thank you for asking. By the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down, and we hung our harps on the willows, etc. That's the 137th Psalm. That's in the middle of a speech that Douglass gives about the 4th of July, and I'll be brief about it, but in the book and elsewhere, I've tried to say that this is Douglass's masterpiece of oratory. Mm-hmm. It is a truly magnificent piece of rhetoric. He worked very hard on it. There's a letter where he says he worked 3 weeks on this speech. It reads like a symphony in three movements. There's the opening where he sets the audience at ease, as Larry just suggested. It's about the first five pages or so. He tells them that the Declaration of Independence is their ring bolt, he calls it. He says the founding fathers were geniuses. This republic was born out of these beautiful ideas. But then about four or five pages in, he starts raining down that pronoun you. Your, mm-hmm. you, your, and then comes down the hammer. It's as though he puts a hammer down up on the lectern and he says, pardon me, why have you invited me here to speak on the 4th of July? The 4th of July is yours, not mine. You may rejoice, I must mourn. And he goes through this constant set of oppositions, you know, you and your, you rejoice, I mourn. And then just floats in to that 137th Psalm, which in effect is saying the children of Israel, when they were captive, were asked to stop and sing for their captors. And Douglass is saying by using that, I did not come here to sing for you. I'm going to make you hurt. And then the second whole movement of the speech, the whole middle of the speech, 10 pages or more, is a litany of the terrors and the horrors of slavery from the holds of the slave ships on through slave auctions, the domestic slave trade, a whole section on the Fugitive Slave Act, on fugitive slave rescues that are going on at that very time. And Douglass just rains this down like a thunderstorm on the audience until there's a break. And he does Jonathan Edwards one better. And he says, "You have a reptile coiled at your heart. Break away, break away. You can still possibly break away. But if you don't, that reptile," meaning slavery, "is going to eat your heart out." And then he pauses. You can feel it in the prose. He pauses. And the last short section of the speech, the third movement, if you want, is short. It's 3-4 pages at most. But it's Douglas kind of letting his audience back up after he's rained down this hailstorm on them. And he says, "Your country is still malleable. It's still possible to save yourselves if you go back to your creeds, if you go back to your promises." And then he ends that speech, incredibly, with a fairly long passage from the poem or hymn written by William Lloyd Garrison called "Go Sound the Jubilee," which is the biblical word for freedom or liberation. So it's a classic Jeremiad. It's the old Puritan tradition of just wrecking down vengeance on your audience, just as the Old Testament prophets did, just as the Hebrew prophets did, as Isaiah did, and as Jeremiah did, saying you will probably have to be destroyed before you can ever remake yourselves.
Wow.
It's a masterpiece of oratory. It's actually, I think, the rhetorical masterpiece of American abolitionism and maybe in all of 19th century letters. But he gave that speech to about 600 people in the beautiful Corinthian Hall in Rochester, who were mostly his neighbors and friends, or at least sympathizers. But Douglas knew what he was doing. He already had that speech printed up, ready to go, and took it on the road with him as he went out to speak that summer and sold it for 50 cents a copy. He was spreading the word. He was always the kind of marketing activist, evangelist of abolitionism, trying to get the biggest possible audiences he could.
Well, so, Professor Blight, how then do we reconcile this commanding moral authority that Frederick Douglass had in his fight to end the catastrophe of slavery with, you know, the complications, we've barely touched on them, that we see sort of unfolding later in his life. For example, there was his complex view of women's suffrage in the context of also trying to win suffrage for all African Americans. He said some quite stunning things about Native Americans that one point in time he said blacks had achieved a character of a civilized man, but that perhaps Native Americans didn't. He also wasn't entirely dismissive of, or didn't dismiss, American imperialism. I mean,
not at all.
These are aspects of Douglass which I honestly, before I read your book, had no idea about.
He's not perfect, and he's also fascinating because he's not perfect. I call him beautifully human. These contradictions are what, in the end of the day, to me as a biographer, is what just continually makes Douglass endlessly fascinating. You mentioned women's suffrage. Indeed, he was a thoroughgoing believer and activist for women's equality. He really was. He was at Seneca Falls, the famous 1848 convention. He was the only male speaker at the Seneca Falls convention. He was a signer of the Declaration of Sentiments. He put the masthead on his newspaper right after that. Which said, right is of no color or sex. And he remained a women's rights activist, even women's economic rights, which were considered, you know, incredibly radical at the time. But when it came to the 15th Amendment during the early years of Reconstruction and coming, you know, to the point of giving black men the right to vote in the Constitution, he parted ways with the leaders of the women's suffrage movement because everybody with one eye open knew that if women's right to vote got into that 15th Amendment, it never would have passed Congress, and even if it had, it certainly would have never passed the 3/4 of the state legislatures to become law. And he had this bitter breakup, at least for a while, with Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Susan B. Anthony, and other leaders of the women's suffrage movement, which left some pretty ugly scars in the kinds of things they ended up saying to one another. Although Douglass, to be perfectly frank, took a lot of that as a gentleman, or as his foes, Stanton and Anthony, showed a deep kind of racism that had always been there. But I do want to say Douglass is this set of contradictions like most great leaders or most great people. He was this radical patriot, as you said earlier. But, you know, he also levied some of the most withering attacks we've ever had on racism and on American hypocrisy and on the craven defenses of slavery. He, on the one hand, you know, always stood up for anyone undergoing oppression and indignity and so on. And yet he became, when the war came, he became a thumping war propagandist, advocating the death and the killing of every slaveholder and every Confederate soldier who defended them in the South. When you read some of his war propaganda during the war years, it will cause you to wince, the kinds of things that he says. He was, on the one hand, always a proponent of the natural rights tradition and the, you know, and equality before law. He was an advocate of activist government. On the other hand, he also preached in season and out black self-reliance, as did most black leaders of the 19th century. So you can find all of these kinds of contradictions in or paradoxes. And then the paradoxes are, of course, also there in his private life.
Right. David Blight, we've just got a couple of minutes left. And, and this brings us to the point in the conversation where we are, you and I are speaking about Frederick Douglass's life. Here we are in 2018 in an America that, of course, has not left the legacy of racism behind in any way, shape, or form. In fact, you know, for many reasons, we can say it's as pressing as ever. So I'm just wondering from this perch here in this year and in this time in the nation as it is now, we've just got a couple of minutes left. I mean, what are the lessons that you think we ought to be taking from Frederick Douglass's life?
Well, as we said earlier, if you read enough Douglass, you'll sometimes think that that sentence or that paragraph was in today's headlines, whether it's him examining the idea of race or the problem of the legacies of slavery or the problem of racial violence or the relationship of the relationship of people to the 14th Amendment's command of equality before law or birthright citizenship. Or even when we're talking about this phenomenon now of mass incarceration, you know, what are we capable of doing, you know, one human being to another? Or the whole idea of how you fight power from outside of that power. Douglass is there as a template. In fact, I think one of the most lasting parts of his legacy is that he is that prototypical example, at least in America, of the old radical outsider, you know, the old activist abolitionist who with time experiences a victory, a real triumph of his cause in the middle of his life, in his 40s, and yet then lives 30 more years to reap what in effect became by the 1880s and 1890s the betrayal and near erasure of those same victories. So what does the radical outsider do when he becomes with time a political insider? And
right.
We now have many examples of those people around the world, from Nelson Mandela to many great leaders of the civil rights movement and even to that that political organizer who became president of the United States.
Well, it seems as if everyone wants to claim Douglass as their own.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He's become a little bit like Lincoln in that sense. Everyone wants to get Douglass on their side. So the conservative movement today, especially libertarians, go in and they pluck out those passages from his writings about self-reliance. But the left plucks out his radicalism. And he's all of those things. You can't fit Frederick Douglass in a box, and it's what makes him so interesting.
Well, David Blight is professor, scholar, and public historian and author of the new biography, Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom. We have an excerpt of the book at onpointradio.org. Professor Blight, it's been a true privilege to speak with you. Thank you so very much.
Thank you, Meghna.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Thank you. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.